Hi, welcome to Jazz on the Tube, and today we have an extraordinary guest with an absolutely intriguing background. He has done an amazing amount of work over the decades to keep jazz alive and popularize it throughout the English-speaking world, so much so that he received a really extraordinary distinction, and it's called the Golden Bandstand Award, and he's one of the few musicians, non-musicians, I should say, to ever receive that award, and he's in the same club as people like Duke Ellington and Count Basie. His name is Henry Holloway, and we're going to be talking about his career as a broadcaster and as a promoter of jazz both in South Africa and throughout the English-speaking world as a radio producer. So welcome, Henry.
Ken, I'm delighted to be on your program. Thank you very much for asking me, and that introduction really... Fortunately, I'm old enough that my head didn't shrink, or rather that my head didn't get too much bigger.
Okay. Now, I already know there is no way we're going to be able to do justice to the entirety of your career in the space of this call. Fortunately, you have a book that's either come out or on the verge of coming out. So let's give people the title so they can note it down.
Right. Thank you, Ken. My autobiography, which will be published in America, which is something pretty unique for a South African. It will be published in America, God willing, next month. It is titled Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz, which is actually the title of my ongoing radio program, which has now been going for 30 years, although I've been a broadcaster for 40 years now. But Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz is the title of my autobiography.
Great. Great title, Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz. And do you offhand, do you know how people can find your radio show? I know it streams live.
Yes, I'm afraid it's not one of those fancy ones that you can listen to days afterwards. You have to catch it when it's broadcast. I used to be on the air every day, but as I got older, I withdrew more and more and more. I have turned 80, believe it or not, although I sound 39. I've been on the air for 40 years, and my radio program, which is also called Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz, is on every Saturday afternoon in South Africa between 5 and 6. Now, when I send out my playlist to my contacts all over the world, I give them the world clock to check their time, like your time would be 7 hours earlier when it's 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon in Cape Town. It will be 7 hours earlier in New York. So you can check with my playlist, but I have to be in touch with you to send you the email, and I can give you right now my email address if there's anybody who's interested who would like to listen to my program. All they need to do is send me an email, and I will put them on my list. It's very simple, Henry, H-E-N-R-Y, of course, at Overnet, the opposite of Undernet, spelled O-V-E-R-N-E-T, Henry at overnet.co.za. We South Africans call it ZA, but you Americans call it ZA. So it's Henry at overnet.co, C for Charlie, O for Oscar, .za.
Great. And people who write you will get a weekly bulletin that reminds them of the show and also gives them their playlist, which is a most remarkable.
Yes, the playlist and also how they can, what they need to click on my email to immediately get my radio station, which is Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Got it. Now, even before you were a broadcaster, you were a promoter of jazz and a producer of concerts and dinner dances and so on.
Yes.
Let's start there, because this is the part that I'm sure it's in your autobiography, but we can get a taste of it now. How did a young fellow living in South Africa discover jazz in the first place, become so passionate about it, and the things that you've done?
Passionate is the word. I was a schoolboy. I was a teenager, and I went to the, every afternoon I used to go to the local cafe where they had those little jukeboxes, every little booth where you sat, they had a private little jukebox, and I used to play. My favorite was Glenn Miller. He was my first idol, and he's probably still my number one idol, although there were many big bands, probably swingier and better, but Glenn Miller certainly was my first idol, and I used to listen to Glenn Miller, and that is how I first became passionate about American music and the great American songbook, the golden age of music, American music particularly. That was how it started with this little teenager in South Africa.
I see. I always ask our guests from different countries, what was the jazz scene like when you were a schoolboy, and how did it evolve over the years? What was going on?
Well, you see, this was in the late 40s and early 50s. It was really much, much better in those days, because that was just before it started going wrong with rock and roll and all that other stuff, I'm afraid. And also the jazz started going too progressive with those fellows who kept on blowing notes in all directions. And my program, I play big band swing, I play the great vocals and the great vocal era, and I play mainstream small group jazz. I like if they play jazz, I like them to play the tune first, the melody as it was composed by the great composers. Then they can improvise, but then they must come back to the music. And I was lucky that when I grew up, fortunately, although it was the tail end of the swing era, yes, it was still primarily the swing era.
Well, South Africa is a long trip for American bands. Did they make it to South Africa to perform?
Oh, look, the musicians or the bands didn't come to South Africa. The records were heard here, and the radio programs, of course.
Wow. So without ever having the opportunity as a young person to see them perform, the records alone were enough to light your passion and set you on your course.
Yes, and of course we saw the movies, the motion pictures had many of the great bands and great artists on, and I was very fortunate when I started broadcasting to go over to America many times and meet some of the legends. Many of them were dead by then, and many of them were old, of course. Well, most of them were old, but I was very fortunate to meet them, and there was always a quid pro quo. When I started my broadcasting career in 1974, my first series was on Glenn Miller, a 21-part series, and I started writing to the Glenn Miller alumni, and they invited me over to their homes, and I stayed with them. I never stayed in hotels. I always had the invitation, but there was a quid pro quo, because they gave me their recordings first, of course, records, and then CDs, and I played them on my radio programs. And so the one hand washes the other one, and so there was a quid pro quo.
Sure, sure. And maybe we could get off on a slight tangent. Chris, you mentioned that Glenn Miller was your first love, so to speak, in
yes.
Jazz. And now you also did some interesting research into his life and his passing. And
yes.
Do you want to talk a little
yes.
bit about that?
Yes, I certainly will. In 1984, when I did my second series on Glenn Miller, that particular series ran for 51 weeks. It was both series were called Miller Magic. And incidentally, I did a third series in 2004, 5, and 6, 115 half-hour programs on Glenn Miller, also called Miller Magic. That's the world record, acknowledged by American and British experts. In 1984, while my series was running, I had a phone call from a fellow who said to me, his name was Fred Shaw, and he was a navigator during the World War, Second World War, and he was on one of the Lancaster bombers, which were sent to bomb Siegen, a little railway siding near Cologne in Germany. But because the weather was so bad, the 138 Lancaster bombers were recalled before they went into German airspace. And as they were coming back, they had to jettison their dangerous bombs, the cylindrical cookies, as they called them, because they couldn't land with them. They were too dangerous because they exploded before they actually hit the surface. And they were jettisoning these bombs in the southern jettison area south of Beachy Head in the English Channel. And Fred Shaw was looking through the little bubble at the bottom of these Lancaster bomber, and he saw these bombs go off, and he saw a little plane down there, little high-wing monoplane, and he recognized it as a Norseman because he trained on Norsemen in Canada early in his career. And he saw the bombs go exploding around it, and the two of his fellow crew members saw it as well. And then they saw the little bomb turn onto its left side, and its left wing go into the channel, and all three of them saw it going in. And when they got back, they were sitting This was on the 15th of December 1944, and they weren't interrogated as they normally do because they didn't complete their mission. But then when they heard on the 24th of December that Major Miller had disappeared on the 15th of December, flying a little Norseman from England to France, they looked at each other and they realized that that must have been the plane in which Major Miller had been. And that is how the story circulated from my Glenn Miller meeting, because Fred Shaw came to my Glenn Miller Society meeting in 1984 and he told the story to my members. And I wrote it up in the mood and sent it all over the world. Now, of course, Dennis Sprague, my dear friend from the Glenn Miller section in Colorado, where the main archive is, Dennis Sprague has researched this tremendously. He's gone to England and he spent a long, long time on it. And he has now he's also written a book called Resolved, and we're waiting for that one, holding our breath for that one to be published. So we'll see whether my Fred Shaw story is the correct one or not, but we don't know yet.
Wow, this great American artist and musician, and this mysterious circumstances and now some possible light after all these years on what happened. Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, on a happier note, your series are amazing. I mean, the idea of 40, 50, 100 programs on a single musician,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's ever done that.
Well,
anywhere.
Nobody has. I mean, there are great American broadcasters, or were, most of them dead now, who also did long series on Miller, but it's been authenticated by experts, American and British, that no other broadcaster has ever done such long series on any single musician or any orchestra as I did.
Wow, and these programs, were they just music or music and commentary? Or how did
No. All my programs, I research them, I compile them, I script them, I produce them, and I present them. So there's not only music, but talk in between.
Wow, that's remarkable. Now, let me ask this question. I'm afraid I can guess the answer. Did anyone record these?
I'm very fortunate, Ken. I'm a collector. I have one of the largest private collections in the world of my type of music, and most of my programs I have kept. My Miller Magic series I have kept, and of course I did many, many series on many other great musicians and bands and singers, of course, and so yes, I've got a lot of this material that I have kept.
Oh, well, that's very good news, because I doubt anyone will ever do anything like this again, and so that you have it in a record of it is fantastic for future generations.
Indeed.
Let's talk a little bit about your visits to America. I have a feeling they were interesting, and I bet you met a lot of great musicians on your trails.
Well, yes. I have made about 10 trips to America, especially in the 80s, and I met so many of the great people. Let me now try and get my old brain right. I mean, especially Glenn Miller people, but let me just run some names past you. Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman, Bob Crosby, Henry and Jenny Mancini, Count Basie, Buddy DeFranco, Les Brown, Billy May, Paul Tanner, Sammy Kahn, Tex Beneke, Teddy Wilson, Neil Hefti, Sammy Kaye, Peanut Sacco, Steve Allen, Paula Kelly, Johnny Desmond, Ray McKinley, Ray Evans, Milt Bernhard, Herb Ellis, Pat Longo, Larry O'Brien, George T. Simon, Doris Day, Abe Most, Terry Gibbs, Al Cohen, Johnny Best. I can go on and on and on and on.
And these are people you spent time with and socialized
absolutely,
with?
Absolutely, absolutely. I spent time with them. I did programs on them. I did series on many of them. I even kissed Ella Fitzgerald's hand. I mean, yes, I kissed her hand. And I've been so fortunate and blessed that I could do this. I've been a very, very blessed man. I wanted to say lucky, but I think it's deeper than that. It goes deeper than that. I'm really blessed.
Wow. You know, we often talk about our jazz musicians in the language of royalty, Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Lady Day.
Yes.
And in my experience, and obviously never had an opportunity to meet them, but so many of the musicians that I meet, they really are, they're remarkable people. They're very dedicated
artists.
Well,
that is, I'm so glad you say that. You know, I have found not a single one of them unpleasant. They're all remarkable. They're all nice. They've all been very nice to me. I mean, people say Artie Shaw was a difficult guy. Yes, he probably was. But he was so charming to me. I mean, even in my book, you will see a letter from Artie saying, Henry, I'd like to come and visit you in South Africa. Let's talk about it. Phone me on so-and-so day, such and such a time. I mean, I visited Artie in his house just outside Los Angeles, and really he was always charming to me and never weird or unpleasant or nasty. Yes, he might have been a bit of a strange guy, but to me he was always charming.
Tell us about some of the, maybe in detail, some of the more memorable meetings or experiences you had with particular musicians. I'm sure there's hundreds of them, but anything that jumps out at you now.
Well, let me just name a few. I mean, Paul Tanner, Dr. Paul Tanner, who played with Glenn, he played fourth trombone. He, of course, afterwards became professor of jazz studies at UCLA for 23 years before he retired. And Paul Tanner was one person who went out of his way. He took me and I took a group of fans over in 1983, and he took me and my group in a bus, and he drove us all over Southern California, and we visited some of his dear friends, names I've mentioned a few moments ago. You know, how many famous legendary people would you get who would do a thing like that?
Yeah.
That's just one. Tex Beneke, who was Glenn's blue-eyed boy in his civilian band. Tex and I spent a lot of time together. Tex told me some amazing stories. Some of them I couldn't divulge. But really, this is the type of person that I mean, Jenny Mancini invited me in 2009 when I was there to her marvelous penthouse, and she invited 20 people, some of them legends, and I was the special guest with all these famous people. On the 28th of September 1999, I was invited by Steve Allen, who is the man for all seasons. You should know Steve Allen's name. And Steve Allen invited me. They had a special evening at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel to pay tribute to Les Brown, because he went into the Guinness Book of Records for leading his band of renown for 60 years. And I was invited by Steve Allen to sit at his VIP table. He was the master of ceremonies. There were two VIP tables, the Brown family table and the master of ceremonies table. Jack Jones was on my left and Larry Gelbart on my right. Larry Gelbart, the famous MASH originator, and we were at Steve Allen's table. And right at the beginning of the evening, there were 1,000 American music VIPs. The place was packed. And right at the beginning of the evening, Steve Allen walked up to the microphone. He cracked two jokes, and he's in the first serious thing. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to welcome a man who's come 10,000 miles from South Africa to be here with us. He has broadcast Les Brown's music and the music of his peers for 25 years internationally, Mr. Henry Holloway." The place erupted. They applauded. I bowed. I smiled. I waved. The television cameras and the floodlights swung over to me. And they just kept on. I mean, these famous, legendary people, you know, and this funny old fellow from South Africa. Can you believe it? Do you know how I must have felt?
It's remarkable. It's just an amazing story. But I'm thinking, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, but, you know, jazz has gone through various cycles of fortune. And, you know, the big band era, as you know, was vast and huge and a large enterprise. And with the introduction of different kinds of music, including rock and roll and changing tastes, things went into a commercial decline, I think. Not an artistic one, but a commercial decline, certainly a relative decline. So someone like you, keeping the torch burning with such excellent programming, probably meant a lot, obviously meant a lot to them.
Well, this is exactly what more than one person, and I'm talking about these legends, have said to me. And they said, "Henry, you are keeping our music alive." I mean, this is absolutely true, and I'm so proud because this is my passion. Jenny Mancini wrote a beautiful introduction to my book, and she said, She said, "I don't know any other broadcaster musicologist anywhere who has a more ardent passion for the great American songbook than Henry has. Henry has lived music, particularly American music, on his radio programs, as so many legends of the music world have attested to, including my late husband, Henry Mancini. It is amazing that one person who lives in South Africa, far removed from the USA, has made such an impact on the American music scene."
And let's point out to our younger listeners, there was no internet.
No internet, my friend.
No YouTube, no MP3s.
And I must tell you, I have no left brain. I can't work most of these things. I'm too stupid.
Well, I hope you have someone emerges who can help you internetize your work, because
I have people who help me when I have a technical problem. I jump on the phone and I get somebody to come over and help me. Fortunately, otherwise I would have been lost. And really, with this autobiography of mine, you know, it runs to almost 700 pages. There are about 500 photographs in it, many letters from these legends, many articles about me. I think it will be a fantastic, almost history of music and of good music. I'm talking about good music.
So in addition to your broadcasting in South Africa, which must have been a great treat for the people that live there, you also had a relationship with the BBC. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I've done a number of broadcasts on the BBC, and they invited me to England. They've come out to South Africa to do broadcasts here with me, and I'm absolutely thrilled that the British have also honored me. Not as much as the Americans. I must tell you that I would say 90% to 10%. Americans 90%, British 10%. So yes, I have broadcast on the BBC, but boy, I'm half American because of the music in me.
Gotcha. So how did people hear your broadcast outside of South Africa? Was it via the BBC, or how did they?
Yes. What happened, first of all, when I started in 1974, I did a number of series on a part-time basis, and then I joined the South African Broadcasting Corporation full-time in 1979. And then, apart from my programs within South Africa, they had what they called the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation, and I was on that service regularly, and that service was especially beamed to Africa and to Europe and to America. And that is where they started hearing me. I got fan mail letters from Americans in those years when the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation was beamed to these countries.
Wow, so you mentioned Africa and Europe, and where else? Was there another country?
And America.
And America.
Yes.
Great. Wow, the good old BBC, they have a long reach.
Well, they have, and I respect them highly in many respects. Look, the shortwave service of the famous shortwave service of America. Oh my goodness, what was that fabulous broadcast?
Voice of America.
Yes, Voice of America. What was their famous broadcaster? He was hardly ever heard in America because he was on the Voice of America, and he was always, "Lordy, lordy, now my 80-year-old brain has stopped." But I listened to him. You might recall his name. Very, very famous broadcaster for the Voice of America. And I listened to his laid-back style, and my style is very laid-back too. I'm not a fast speaker as most of the broadcasters are. I'm more laid back, and I'm more deliberate in my presentations. If you listen to my programs, you'll understand what I'm trying to say.
Well, it's fairly rare for a radio broadcaster in any genre to script and so carefully prepare every program. Like normally, people spin records, and they'll make comments, and the comments are good.
Yes.
But the idea of someone, you know, researching and scripting their shows with such care, that's extremely rare. I can't think of any. I mean, if someone's doing a special program, maybe, but it's not the norm.
Well, this is the interesting thing. I've listened to various programs on the internet. I discovered a new one just yesterday, and they play beautiful swing music and old-style music, my type of music, but they have nobody announcing it. They just have adverts in between, and then they have music, wall-to-wall music. Beautiful music, most enjoyable. If you don't like a guy talking in between, that's fine. But I like to explain each and every one. I don't stretch it beyond 40 seconds, but my announcements, I give background information about each song or tune that I play. Composer, lyricist, date recorded, the artist, the soloist, I like to do that.
Well, I as I was saying to another guest we had, it's all part of music what they used to call music appreciation.
Yes.
Which is, of course, the music speaks for itself.
Yes.
But if you can put it in a historical context and people
yes.
know who the different players are and they know the histories
yes.
of the tunes and the circumstances
yes.
of the performance, it just
yes.
adds to the experience.
I believe so, Ken. I believe that if you tell the story about the item that you're playing, it brings it out so much. It brings it to the fore. It gives that background information that I mentioned. Willis Conover, the name has come to me, the famous Willis Conover, Voice of America. You ever heard of Willis Conover?
Well, you know, because, you know, the Voice of America is considered a sort of an external...
Exactly.
Legally, it's not allowed to be broadcast in the United States.
Exactly.
So I never
that's
heard
why,
the name of it.
That's why Americans do not know en masse the famous Willis Conover, one of the best broadcasters I've ever heard in my life. He was on the Voice of America. And you know, I have a letter from the director of the Voice of America who visited South Africa, and I met him at the ambassador's house in Cape Town, and he wrote me a letter, and he said when he got back, Henry, I spoke to Willis Conover here, and I told him that you are the Willis Conover of South Africa. Now that, to me, do you know what that means to me? You cannot believe it, Ken.
Wow. So were you actually hearing his broadcast?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I got it. Wow. You know, rightfully so, there's a tremendous amount of focus on the musicians, of course, but there's a whole world of people like yourself and like Mr. Conover and other guests we've had who provide this support and, I don't know what the correct word is, but that enables, for lack of a better word, the music
yes.
to spread and to find new listeners.
Correct.
And this is so important. And I think your story's, I hope, inspiring to our listeners that, you know, if you have the passion and are willing to put in the work, you can find vehicles for that passion, and it will be well-received in time because people do love this music and they love a chance to be exposed to it.
Well, you are 100% right. It's the exposure because of the passion of people like myself, and I jokingly sometimes call myself a nut, but I'm not really a nut. I'm passionate about the golden age of music and particularly of American music, as Jenny Mancini said in endorsement to my autobiography. And by the way, Ken, just to deviate for a moment, my wife was one of the best broadcasters ever in South Africa, and she's 10 years younger than I am. She is now doing her doctoral thesis. She did her master's thesis on the lyrics of Cole Porter. And she's
really?
Doing her doctoral thesis on the lyrics of Sammy Kahn. Now, this might tickle you because Cole Porter is much, much more famous than Sammy Kahn. But Sammy Kahn holds the world record for a lyricist. He won 26 Oscar nominations and 4 Oscars. And Johnny Mercer comes second with 18 nominations and 4 Oscars for a lyricist. And Sammy Kahn I knew very well. I visited him many times at his home in Beverly Hills, North Cannon Drive, and I took my new bride in 1986, Marilyn, to his house, and she met him, and she interviewed him for Women's World. She was the editor and presenter of Women's World. And we've got a lot of material spoken. I did a 13-part series on Sammy Kahn in 1988, and he specially sat down and recorded all the spoken inserts for me. So we've got a lot of material by Sammy. So Marilyn is doing her doctorate on the lyrics of Sammy Kahn. So there you are. You've got music in the Holloway household all the time.
Extraordinary. It's interesting you mentioned the academic side of jazz.
Yes.
I remember I first got involved in jazz as a high school student, which was the 70s, the mid-70s. And then I got involved professionally in 1980 as the interim manager of a jazz record label called Indian
right.
Navigation. And I was 20,
yes.
And it was New York City. And my impression at the time was that jazz was really struggling on a business basis.
Yes.
And
yes.
I was even wondering, in fact, I wrote my thesis, it was about for my bachelor's degree, it wasn't PhD, but my bachelor's
right.
degree thesis was, where are we going to get new musicians from? Because the
right.
clubs were gone, the playing opportunities were gone, and all the informal networks whereby people
yes.
would learn. And I wasn't sanguine about the prospects. Well, here we are, 34 years later, and there's hundreds of jazz programs now in the United States alone where young people can go and learn either the academic side or the performing side.
Yes.
I think there's a real renaissance going on. I wonder what your impression is of where we are with jazz today.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because this is exactly what's happening. You're on the spot. You know, a very dear friend of ours is Professor Doug Masick. He has now, in fact, taken Paul Tanner's place at UCLA. He's in charge of jazz studies at UCLA. And Dougie is a dear friend of ours. He came and played at my studio, Swingdom, which, by the way, the American ambassador officially opened. And Doug Masick was the saxophone player, and he brought his quartet out here, played at my studio, my home studio, and among other places. And that's exactly what Doug said and did, because he started playing sax, but he also started studying, and he is now, as I say, at UCLA in charge of the jazz department, and he's a relatively young man, and this is what's happening. Fortunately for good jazz, those crazy cuckoos who, as I said earlier, blew notes in all directions and atonal notes, and it didn't make sense to me. They've come and they've gone, and you still get a lot of that. But thank heavens, you still get younger musicians. I'm talking about Americans, particularly playing the good music, playing yes the tune, yes improvise, yes get back to the tune.
Okay. When we talk about the academic approach to jazz, it's so refreshing because it's a serious art with a serious history. And maybe
the only art form America has given the world.
Right. And I actually lately, and I wonder your reaction to this, I think even that understates the issue, because I think if when you look at jazz, it's almost like looking at Periclean Athens or looking at the Renaissance in Italy. So many talented musicians, all at one time, all flowering at the same time and creating an amazing body of work. I really think jazz is that significant. I think it's of, you know, in that order of magnitude when you look at the history of human creativity.
Indeed. And thank heavens for that, and thank heavens that the good music will continue as long as we live, and we can look back. I'm Madeline often says to me, "You've got to look ahead, buddy." I say, "Darling, I'm a nostalgic. I look back. You do your doctorate. You look ahead. I will look back, and I will play my old music."
Fair enough. So, Henry, if you could tell us again the name of your forthcoming autobiography,
yes.
so people can make
yes.
sure to.
Thank you, Ken, for asking. It's called Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz. Big band swing, the great vocals, and mainstream small group jazz. Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz. It will be published by Trafford Publishers in Bloomington, Indiana. It's due to come out or be published next month. It will be available on all these fancy technical things, what do you call them, Amazon.com and also at Barnes and Noble bookstores all over America. and then in Britain as well, and then in South Africa as well. They have them, of course, on the electronic basis and also in book form, although many bookstores have closed, but there still are many open. So if anybody would like to look out for it at one of these places, Swing, Sing, and All That Jazz, the autobiography of Henry Holloway. And on my cover it says, I'm humbly very proud, which is an oxymoron, I say one of only two people in the world who has been honored with America's prestigious Golden Bandstand Award. And in the company of people like Frank Sinatra, Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, boy, oh boy, that's not bad company to be in.
It is really remarkable, and it shows that no matter where you are on this planet, if you have an ear and a heart, you can be part of the jazz world and even make significant, massive contributions to it.
Well, it's my life, Ken. I mean, I'm much of a square. I mean, I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I'm not a drinker. I'm just a straightforward, up and down old fellow who was very fortunate to have music. Bumped into Glenn Miller at a jukebox in my little old hometown after school, and the bug just bit me, and it's been nibbling away at me ever since. And I'm just very, very fortunate.
Well, as an American and a jazz lover, I'm always grateful for all the people like yourself in other countries that have embraced our music and, helped make sure it stayed alive and gave it its due and helped promote it. It's just been a wonderful thing to see that happen around the world, not just in the United States.
Well, you might be interested, when I got the letter from Milt Bernhardt about my Golden Bandstand Award in late 2002, I got it, by the way, in Los Angeles on the 2nd of March 2003. But when the news of this high honor hit the newspapers, I received so many letters from South African people like the former state president and Nobel Peace Laureate, Mr. F.W. de Klerk, and from Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who is also a Nobel Peace Laureate, and also from Cyril Ramaphosa, who is today the Vice President of South Africa, Gary Player, our famous golfer. You know, I can go on and on. So many famous people wrote wonderful letters to me. They're all in my book, of course, and photographs were then taken of me with these famous people holding my Golden Bandstand Award. And, oh, man, Ken, I'm just, again, humbly very proud.
It must have been an unbelievable experience. Well, Henry Holloway, we appreciate the time that you spent with us and your lifetime of work and the insights and experiences you shared with us today. And I strongly encourage everyone to look for Henry's book. We will put a link to the website where Henry's show is broadcast from live. Unfortunately, no podcast. You have to get it live. But hey, if you're a fan, it's okay. It's well worth it. And we'll also put Henry's email address. If you're interested in this kind of music, you must write him and get on his list, because he'll not only remind you of when the show is, he'll send you his playlists, and his playlists are golden. They're a book unto themselves. So great, Henry, thanks so much, and I hope someday, who knows, I might visit you here or there or who knows where, but I do enjoy your show, and I look forward to your book.
Ken, thank you very much. I'm hoping very much to come to the USA to do some book signings, and if I'm in New York, especially in New York City, well, I hope that we can have a cup of coffee together.
Great, and let me know when that happens, because I will make sure that our Jazz on the Tube fans go to wherever your signings are. I'm sure they'd love to shake your hand and get your book.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Great.
Ken, it's been a real pleasure. It's been my honor talking with you, and thank you very much for getting me into your loop, and I hope that your listeners will find something of interest in our little chat that we had.
Very good. Well, best wishes to you and all your loved ones, and hope to see you in New York.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you very, very much again, and all the very best with your program.